Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. In today's episode, I spoke with Karen Ruffel, author of Gender, Sainthood, and Everyday Practice in South Asian Shiism, from University of North Carolina Press in 2011. What does a wedding in Karbala in the year 680 have to do with South Asian Muslims today? As it turns out, this event informed contemporary ideas of personal piety and social understandings of gender roles. The battlefield wedding of Qasim and Fatima Kubra on the 7th of Muharram is commemorated annually by Hyderabadi Shia Muslims. In Gender, Sainthood, and Everyday Practice in South Asian Shiism, Karen Ruffel explores the relationship between devotional literature and ritual practice in the formulation of social consciousness and embodied ethics. She accomplishes this task through great ethnographic detail and deep investigation into a rich literary tradition of devotional hagiographical text. Ruffel argues that hagiography, when enacted through contemporary ritual performances, establishes typologies of Shia sainthood. Altogether, these localized models of ethics and gender normativity reflect the realities of the religiously plural geographies Hyderabadi Shia Muslims inhabit. In our conversation, we discuss annual mourning assemblies, Husseini ethics, gender roles, martyrdom and kinship, the relationship between texts and performance, vernacular and cosmopolitan Islams, sectarian affiliation, and the homogenization of Shiism. Without further ado, here's our interview. Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Karen Ruffel about her new book, Gender, Sainthood, and Everyday Practice in South Asian Shiism. Welcome, Karen. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thanks for agreeing to do this and giving me a copy of your wonderful book. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Before we get into some of the themes you explore in the book, maybe you could just kind of give us some of your background, where you got interested in religion, in South Asia, in Islamic studies in particular, and maybe some people that have kind of been reflective on your approach to Islamic studies.
Sure, I'll be happy to talk about that. But first, I'd like to thank you for asking me to talk about the book today. I have a very long history sort of with Islam that actually goes back to childhood. I was one of these very kind of geeky children that was interested in the world. I grew up in Middlebury, Vermont, which is the home to Middlebury College, where each summer they're very famous for their summer language institutes. And so I grew up with Arabic being taught in my hometown, and being a small college town also affected the kind of elementary school that we had, which was very progressive and had special learning programs for students. And I was able to spend a fair amount of time each week doing my own research and following questions that I had. And in sixth grade, for example, I did a project on Israel, and at that point I was not very evolved politically, and I only had one sentence about the Palestinians in that project, but it was my first experience doing field work. I actually interviewed one of the Jordanian families in Middlebury, and I interviewed some Jewish families, and so that was at about the age of 11 or 12, my first field work experience, and I really enjoyed it. And I also, by the time I was a freshman in high school, I was in world history class, and we had to do projects, and I decided I'd do my project on Islam. And I got very excited. Instead of writing like a 2 or 3 page paper, I wrote a 15 page paper. And I remember I said, yeah, it started early. I remember I said to my mother as I was doing this research, wow, I think I know what I want to do. And so I continued studying on my own. And when I applied to colleges, I knew I wanted to keep working on Islam, but how I was going to do that, I wasn't quite certain, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I ended up kind of taking the lazy way out, and I went to Middlebury College, and there I worked with Tazim Qassam, who has been a really profound influence in my life, and she really, in many ways, shaped the direction that I took in my study of Islam. I took every course that she offered, and it was really, I think, very refreshing for me. The courses that she offered were not entirely Arab world focused. I was able to do coursework on Shiism at the undergraduate level and at an advanced level, and was able to do a lot of research on my own. And the South Asia dimension didn't really come in until my junior year of college. I was at the American University in Washington, D.C., and I was doing a semester program while I was working for in the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, or ADC. I was working as a media intern, and I wanted to keep doing that, but I needed to stay in school. And so I did this international relations program, and I remember on one of the days we always had we either went on field trips every week or we had guest lectures, and we had a Sikh woman come in and speak, and she was a convert to Sikhism. And for some reason, that class had a real impact on me, and I started thinking, well, what about Shiism in South Asia instead of just Shiism in Iran, which is where my original interest was. And when I returned to Middlebury to finish my last year and a half, I was focused. I started doing a lot more coursework on South Asia in addition to Islamic studies, and decided that I wanted to go to graduate school and get a PhD in South Asian Islam. And so I started working toward that goal. And after I graduated, I did a summer studying Telugu at Madison, Wisconsin, and I knew I wanted to work in Hyderabad. I don't know why, but I wanted to work in Hyderabad and in South Central India, which is the field site for my book, and is also the site of ongoing research that I'll tell you about in a little while. I ended up going to India later after I graduated, about a year after I graduated, and I worked a whole bunch of odd jobs. And then I went to Yemen, and I applied to graduate school after taking those 2 years off, which was really very helpful. And then I enrolled at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where I worked with Carl Ernst. And it was an interesting time for Islamic studies because I started in the fall of 1998. And so it was a few years before September 11th. And I was one of the very few students at UNC doing Islamic studies at that time. And it really took off in the years after September 11th. But there were a number of students at Duke University who were, you know, much further along than I was. And so that was definitely an interesting time for me. And I was able to do a lot of work on my own and really pursue my interests in sort of a really very independent way. And then I started going to India and Pakistan almost every year to study Urdu, to do research, to do field work. And then I spent about a little over 2 years in the field doing in Iran, Syria, and mostly in Hyderabad from between 2004 and 2006, doing my field research that makes up this book. And as far as influences, as I mentioned, Tazim Qassam has been a very profound influence. And then two professors that I had in grad school have also had a deep influence on my work. Carl Ernst, obviously, I did a lot of coursework with him. He very patiently did reading courses in Persian and in Arabic with me, and I learned a lot about the importance of the text and how to really to put texts and textual traditions in relationship with lived practice. And then Tony Stewart, who's now at Vanderbilt University, was extremely helpful for me in terms of theorizing, figuring out how do I interpret all of this material. And so really these three figures have had a lasting impact on my work.
Yeah, you can definitely see how these interests are all tied together in this book. Maybe you could explain a little bit how this particular topic that you explore came about.
Okay, yes. This is also another sort of long story in the sense that I kept having experiences that happened over and over and over again, ultimately drawing me to the case study that I use in the book, this marriage that Hyderabad Shia in particular believe happened at the Battle of Karbala between Imam Hussein's daughter Fatima Kubra and her cousin Qasim. In 2002, I spent a summer in Lucknow doing field research, and I did some interviews with Urdu scholars who are working on Marsiya, a genre of Shi'i devotional literature that's very similar. I think it has epic qualities to it. It's long. It tends to be lengthy as far as poetry goes. It's narrative. Characters are set up. Heroes and heroines are established in certain ways. And then I interviewed this one particular scholar. And for some reason, I decided to ask questions about this one particular celebration or event on the 7th of Muharram. And he said, well, this event, we don't observe this anymore in Lucknow. It's superstition. It emphasizes practices that are not truly Islamic. All of these wedding rituals are superstition. We don't do that. Instead, we observe the sacrifice of Fiza, the Abyssinian slave that worked for Fatima. And then after Fatima died, the Prophet Muhammad's daughter Fatima, after she died, she remained in the employ of the Ahle Bayt and was at the Battle of Karbala according to tradition. So he really emphasized that, and like, that's more progressive. And I thought, okay, well, that's an interesting response. And I kind of just sat on that for a while and didn't think too much about it. But then when I was doing a reading course in Persian with Carl, I'd selected to work on Kashafi's Rosat al-Shuhada, the Garden of the Martyrs, and I chose that narrative to analyze, and it captured my imagination. I just thought there was a lot there, that the emotions, the feelings, the experience, and the open-endedness of the narrative at the end after Qasim is martyred, and the chapter ends with Fatima Kubra reciting a poem, as happens at emotionally intense moments in this book. And it got me thinking, maybe I should use this as the focus. And so I went to Iran in 2004 and started interviewing mullahs about, and other research scholars about this text. And they all said, it's garbage. It's terrible. Why am I working on this? And I was kind of devastated. I was like, oh no, what am I going to do? And so I started thinking about the text and the kinds of critiques that were leveled. And I talk about this in the book, but I thought, well, this is being treated as history, and it's not history. And it does have meaning for people. These narratives do have meaning. And when I got to Hyderabad, my hunches were validated when I saw just how important the 7th of Muharram is. I mean, it really sort of marks the emotion. Aside from the 10th of Muharram, it's the start of these four really intense days during Muharram, and the wedding resonates in people's everyday lives, and so it just was several years of these experiences that kind of came together, and I realized that obviously there was something important there, and it seemed like a good way to ask some of the, by focusing on this wedding and then all of the rituals and devotional literature that's developed on this topic, that maybe I should use this rather than looking at a whole range of Muharram events or activities, but to take one event and then really do a close and in-depth analysis of that to pull out an understanding of, well, how are things like gender roles taught? How do people relate to these figures as saints? And as saints, what kind of saints are they? And so I was really able to kind of ask a whole range of questions. How do these figures function in the devotional literature? Why is this event so contentious? And it's been the subject of debate. You know, is it permissible to observe the Mendi Ki Mejlis, the Henna Morning Assembly? I mean, there have been debates about this since the mid-19th century.
Well, you do a great job. And I think this relationship between text and practice is really important. I want to kind of ask you about that, because this makes up a lot of what you're exploring here. Can you explain kind of the nature of hagiographical literature in South Asia and maybe how this might differ from hagiographical literature in other places? Or does it?
Yeah, okay. So why don't I start with the first part of the question and move on to the second part of the question. I think the first thing that needs to be done is just to specify I'm talking about Shi'i hagiographical literature. I think Sufi hagiographies function differently. And in the Sunni, you know, and then in the larger Sunni tradition, I would say they also operate differently, but this, because this literature focuses on a set number of people, the 12 imams and other members of the Prophet Muhammad's household who obtain their descent through his daughter Fatima Zahra and her husband and Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law Ali. Then I use the term Ahle Bayt, the people of the household, as a shorthand for these figures, these people who have this blood descent. I see the hagiographical literature that focuses on the lives and the sacrifices of these figures as hagiographical. It conforms to a number of qualities of hagiography. It extols the religious virtues of these figures. It sets them up as moral exemplars. It establishes their difference from regular people, yet I also argue, at least for the Ahle Bayt, that these figures, while being exceptional, we can take on their qualities through practice, through hearing these stories, through focusing on the sacrifices that they made, engaging with the fact that women were a really important part of the Ahle Bayt, and these stories actually are telling the stories that the women told, because it was the women who survived. But hagiography also has another really important function, and that's that it serves as a bridge, in a sense, between sort of prescriptive traditions of law and theology that tell you how to behave, and then sort of more popular, or what, I don't like the kind of high popular binary here, but there are sort of, there's at the everyday dimension, and people don't read books of theology and law on an everyday practice. And so these types of stories about exceptional people teach those rules, those prescriptive norms. And they also come together to tell the lives of these individuals and also the values that they're imparting through culturally meaningful idioms. So these figures are not the same all over the Shi'i world. For example, Abbas, the half-brother of Imam Hussein, who was martyred getting water for the children in the entourage at Karbala. He was filling water skins. And in Iraq, for example, he is sort of this hyper-masculine Uberman. And then in the Deccan, for example, where the region where Hyderabad is located, he's a much softer and gentler figure. He's uncle. There are so many poems that extol the relationship between Imam Hussein's youngest daughter, Sakina, and Abbas. And these poems are really heartrending. She's saying, "Uncle, you'll never get up from the sand again. You'll never do this again. You'll never do that again." And he's not this super tough guy. And so I think that culture is in sort of the local context, which is why we can't say one version of this hagiographical tradition is the same all over the world. These figures are sort of stock figures, but they become real once they're put into these local contexts, and they become perhaps in some ways, aside from the standard things, so Abbas was the water bearer. But aside from that, that Iraqi Abbas and the Deccani Abbas may in some ways be mutually unintelligible for Shi'i devotees in those two places, because he really becomes a very different person. And so for this reason, we have to pay attention to what hagiography does, because it's not the same in all places. It's taking the standard elements from a script and making it meaningful in a particular place.
The other half of this that it becomes essential to your study is this idea of ethnography. And I'm wondering if you could give us your thoughts just on, just in general, the importance of ethnography for Islamic studies. And maybe even though there is more and more scholars doing ethnography in Islamic studies, why is there still a hesitation to do field work?
Well, one of the problems with doing field work, and this will sound really perhaps jaded, but it makes doing research a lot more complicated, because you're working with living people. And you can't just go into an archive for 2 or 3 weeks and then you're done with the archival work. You can then go home, you can work on it, and that's it. It's, with ethnography, it's a really important part of this is building relationships. It takes time. It requires sort of ongoing and sustained relationships. And you're also, in some ways at the whim of your community. Will you be accepted? What kind of information will you be authorized by the community to obtain? These are all really important challenges. The first time I went to Hyderabad to kind of get to know leaders in the Shi'i community, I was still a grad student. It was before I hadn't taken my exams yet. And so I was not taken terribly seriously. It's just like, oh, it's another grad student here doing field work. And when I returned in January of 2005, after I'd spent 4.5 months in Iran and had gone to Damascus and done pilgrimage at the shrine of Sayyidah Zainab, then I was taken a lot more seriously. I'd established my credentials and I was given more access in the community, but there were still a number of ritual practices that I only found out about well after the fact, because there was a certain, I think, degree of censorship, censoring from within the community. Well, you don't need to know about these practices, or these are, we ourselves see these as superstitious, or may think that somebody from outside will see these practices as superstitious or this or that, whatever the reason may be. But I think one of the problems or one of the challenges in Islamic studies is that we have tended to privilege sort of the high traditions of philosophy and law and theology. And with that, we've tended to privilege textual traditions instead of engaging with those textual traditions and then seeing how Muslims themselves are engaging with this. I think the moment we bring in the human dimension, it gets really messy because there is no one answer. And we get conflicting. One person will say this, another person will say this. What do you do with that? How do we deal with these conflicts within communities, these divergences of opinion or interpretation? But one of the biggest challenges that we have in North America in particular, and I think considering recent events, is that we have to understand Muslims, not just Islam, but we have to understand Muslims and Muslim practices, Muslim beliefs, the contours of everyday life. We can't also, you know, this, I think we have to also be aware of the danger of reducing Muslims to their religious identity. That's only part, a very small part. And this is one thing I really try to bring out in the book, that, for example, the Shi'i community I work with in Hyderabad, they're not just Shia, but they're Hyderabadi, they're professionals, they're this, they're that, they're, you know, they have family relationships and all of the complications of family relationships. And we really have to look at the ways in which, as human beings, we're multiply situated. And there are lots of elements that make us who we are. And that takes, I think it takes a lot of time to be able to do that.
Well, I hope you have a couple more of these thematic approaches from your research, because I think that's one of the parts that makes your book so successful, is this relational activity between practice and text. And you do a very good job of kind of parsing those out. So thank you. One idea that I want you to explain, because you explored at great length, is this difference between what you call Husseini ethics and imitable sainthood. Can you explain what those two are and the relationship between them?
Sure. And maybe I can also introduce the other sort of binary, or the other half of that binary. So I see these as paired, as complements to each other. This notion of imitable sainthood and Husseini ethics, which really draws from a term that we find used fairly often in Urdu, Husseiniyat, to refer to this whole sort of spirit and ethic of sacrifice and commitment to social justice and family and faith that permeates these narratives that are told in poetry, that are narrated in the majlis, in the morning assemblies. And the Husseini ethic is emphasized in different ways with different figures from the Ahl-e Bayt. Certain figures emphasize bravery, for example, Zainab, Imam Hussein's sister, who survived the Battle of Karbala and stood up to Yazid in his darbar in Damascus. She's often characterized as being really brave and of the people. And she's the one who, I think in chapter 3 of my book, I translate a narrative from Mir Alam, who was the prime minister during for one of the Asif Jai kings in Hyderabad. And he wrote in Deccani Urdu translation of Kashafi's Rozat al-Shuhada. This narrative is completely different from the Persian narrative because it's all about the women. In fact, the battle is minimized. It's not very important. And every time something happens, Zainab steps in and takes control. And so everybody has a certain set of qualities that they exemplify and embody with regard to this Husseini ethic, this spirit of sacrifice and faith and integrity. And I see this Husseini ethic as imitable. It's something that one can, if you practice, if you have faith, if you want to take on and embody these positive qualities, then their sainthood is imitable. These aren't these sort of otherworldly figures. They're really earthy. They're wives and husbands and fathers and sons and sisters and brothers. That the dimension of kin relationship is also very, very important, which is why the feminine dimension, the centrality of women is so absolutely important in Shi'i devotionalism. It's because we have this imitability. It's not just about men, but women are also really central to this. And when you have this, then it means that both women and men can participate in some ways on their own terms and through their own gendered experiences in trying to be like these exemplary figures. This pairing of Husseini ethics and imitable sainthood, I see as, in a sense, the flip or the sort of other complement to what the qualities that the imams possess. And I also pair together imamat and walaya, or this what I call transcendent sainthood in the book, that these are figures who are much more otherworldly. You know, they are transcendent in a way because they possess this initiatic knowledge of the Quran. Their authority is passed down through divine designation, through nas, from one imam to the next. And these are qualities that we don't have as regular people and we can't possess. And so these figures are, while people do want to take on certain qualities that the imams have, because of these, you know, this really sort of the role of initiatic or special knowledge and divine designation makes it more difficult to really be like them. And I see that get played out narratively in devotional poetry or in these Deccani Urdu translations of Rozatul Shahada, that Imam Hussein, for example, his role is set. He's going to die. He'll be martyred at the Battle of Karbala. And so whenever there's an emotional scene, there's some sort of emotional climax or some sort of personal interaction between two of the figures, that he comes in and then he leaves, because there's no space for engagement in a way for him, because he's leaving. And this isn't something that an epic hero does, for example. And I make comparisons to King Rama of the Ramayana also as an epic hero, that in that role, there's very little space for development of character. There's very little space for ambiguity for these epic heroes, whereas for the women, because they survived and their future is much more open, they do have room for development, for emotionally engaging. And it's in the literature that we really see the use of female voices and emotions to carry and to produce the sort of desired aesthetic effects of grief and sorrow and wanting to be, wanting to have been at the Battle of Karbala, to also share in that ethic of sacrifice.
Just so I'm sure that we make it there, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. You do a great job. You're really theoretically very rich in the book, and I appreciate both your comparative analysis, where you liken these models to other traditions, but also within the Islamic tradition, you look at these kind of in multiple from multiple angles. Could you, though, jump ahead to talk about this Majlis ceremony, this commemoration, and how the figures of Qasim and Fatima Kubra play out in this? What does this scene look like?
Okay.
And then what do these things represent?
Okay. So I'll describe what is probably the biggest Mendiki Majlis that takes place in Hyderabad. It takes place at the home of Dr. M.M. Taqi Khan, who was a chemistry professor. He worked for Government of India for a long time. He comes from several generations of Shi'i notables in Hyderabad. And so they've been hosting the Mendiki Majlis in Hyderabad for a long time. It's been almost 100 years now at this point. And for the men's, one thing to explain, the Majlis is usually sex segregated, although there are exceptions to this, but they are rare. Usually there will be a men's majlis and a women's majlis, although women are always present at the men's majlis. They'll sit either behind some sort of curtain or be in a separate room, especially if it's a majlis that takes place in a house, for example. They may be in a separate room, but still able to listen and participate. I've attended both the men's and women's majlis at the Khan family residence, which is located in Hyderabad's old city in a neighborhood called Yakutpura. And they have a very large ashrakhana, a ritual space where alums and iconic hands. I mean, they usually are sort of, they look like the hand of Fatima, something similar to that. And they represent different figures of the Ahle Bayt. And the Khan family has been devotees, so to speak, of Qasim for a very long time. And so they have an old alum dedicated to Qasim and then this ashrakhana. So that's under sort of on a long porch. And then there's a big courtyard and the house. And the women stay in the living room, the women of the family. And then there's also space for sort of more everyday women from the locality to come and participate in the majlis. And generally, the way the majlis takes place, there will be, it starts off with recitation of poetry. And these are usually salams, so sort of poems of invocation that set the mood. Then there may be recitation of portions of marsiyas, these longer, more epic quality, these longer poems with an epic quality. The whole thing isn't recited, but portions, certain verses may be recited at the discretion of the Marsiya Khan, the person who is reciting the poetry. And so people listen to this. Some people may gently beat their breasts, or weep. Then the zakir, the rememberer, will sit either on a mimbar or on a chair that's elevated in sort of the center of the crowd or in the center of the space. And everybody gathers around and listens to a recitation from the Quran, something that sets the theme. So each majlis has a particular theme. And so it may be bravery, it may be courage, sacrifice. There will be different themes for each majlis. And the zakir chooses, will think about who's going to be the audience at this majlis. What theme will make them connect? And then really start thinking about, for example, the wedding of Fatima Kubra and Qasim. And so one year, one of the majlis, in this one particular majlis, the theme and the narrative really focused on, you know, what happens when a man and a woman get married, and the social critique that takes place when a young woman marries a man. People say, oh gosh, you know, don't let her become a widow, because basically her social life is over. And so the narrative reflected, you know, this is a really important event. And look at how we, you know, in our own practices say, you know, oh, things will be really bad for this woman if her husband dies. And so it's is supposed to that the Zakir's commentary is supposed to get people thinking, oh, is this good? Are some of these things that we do, are they helpful? Are we reflecting the positive qualities of Fatima Kubra and Qasim when we're already concerned about the husband possibly dying and making his wife a widow before the wedding's even happened? Here's this joyful event. We're not worrying about justice or what's in the best interest of the bride or groom or whatever. And so it sets this really important tone that then as the emotional shift takes place, the narrative turns into Messiah, the narration of the sufferings of the particular, you know, hero that's being focused. And so in this case of Fatima Kubra and Qasim and their wedding. And at the emotional peak of this, the alam gets covered up. So before the majlis even starts, the metal part of the alam is covered. It's wrapped and wrapped and wrapped and wrapped because it goes out in a procession and it goes out upright. So some of the son-in-laws of Dr. Khan will take the alam out through the crowd, and people are scrambling to touch it and to receive the barakah, the blessing and grace that emanates from the alam. And it will go out and do a circuit through the crowd. And then it will come into the women's space and then on its way back. And that symbolizes Qasim is going on his wedding procession. So on Barat, where he goes to the house of his bride and takes her back. This is a very South Asian ritual. And then when he returns, so when the alam or Qasim returns back to the porch where the alam is kept, a bloody cloth is put on over the alam, and it's brought back. Instead of standing upright, it's carried horizontally. So to represent a funeral bier. And the other thing that happens at this point, so it becomes really chaotic. I mean, there's so many things that are happening at once. So that's one thing that's happening. Then also, prior to the majlis, Dr. Khan and his daughters prepare trays of henna that also go out in procession. And people make mad dashes to try and grab a bit of this henna paste off the plate, which then they will dab onto the right palm of their hand. And the hope is, the expectation is that through the intercession of Qasim, that man or that woman who's put the henna paste on their right palm will get married in the next year. And I've heard many, many stories from Shias that, in fact, shortly after that Muharram cycle, the days of mourning, a marriage, you know, they got married. And it was because of the grace of Qasim's intercession. So that's also happening. And people are scrambling to get the henna paste. And then also groups, men break off into groups. They're members of Matami Guruhan, or these associations of people who self-flagellate, will strike themselves. And this is just striking with the hand. And so one person who's called a Noha Khan, a person who recites nohas, or short rhythmic rhyming poetry that, you know, is supposed to cite feelings of profound grief that then people will beat their chests in time to the rhythm of the poem. So people are also gathered in groups. So you have maybe 10 different groups of Noha reciters and people performing Matam also. So this is also happening all at the same time. And this goes on for maybe about 15 minutes. And so this people just, you know, ascend. The emotional peak is, you know, it's building and building and building. And then finally, it comes down and it ends. And people kind of enter back into into their own bodies in a way. The sacrifice has been made. The encounter with the Baraka of Qasim has taken place. And then there are some final prayers, and people will have tabaruk. They'll have blessed food. And so it ends also with this really important act of hospitality, where people are given, you know, and each majlis is famous for different foods, and that's in itself a whole different story. But I think also this issue of hospitality is really significant. But you can see just in this hour and a half or so. The men's majlis tends to be about an hour and a half. There's a lot that happens, and you know, it takes a while to learn how to read the events, and you know, especially the symbolism. These events are so deeply laden with symbolism. It's not just about the zakir telling you what you should believe or what you should feel, but there are all of these other sensory experiences that are so central to this.
Yeah, this is fascinating, and you paint a very good picture in the book. So the one of the parts I like a lot about the book is you give these kind of day-to-day conversations that you have that reflect how people understand these events. Could you talk about what do then people do with this in their daily life?
There are a number of people who kind of show up repeatedly in the book. Dr. Khan and his daughter Kulsum are two figures who show up a fair amount, and then a woman named Sabiha, who is the daughter of one of the senior most religious scholars, Shi'i religious scholars in Hyderabad, a man named Syed Reza Agha. Sabiha, I interviewed her a number of times, and my first conversations with her were really surprising in some ways, because I was really interested, as I started this project, in the gendered dimensions of this particular narrative. And I was going in my own perceptions and expectations about how do women deal with widowhood. How do they feel about this? How do they feel about this, you know, marriage being compulsory? Because it really is compulsory. It's compulsory in South Asia. People tend not to remain single. And having a family is, you know, really provides a central aspect of being for, you know, in the world, for people, whether you're Hindu or Muslim or Christian or whatever. And so some of my own values and assumptions were really challenged. And one of my first interactions with Sabiha, we were talking about, you know, she's telling me about how, you know, she's really well educated, she's running the school, she's a professional woman. But then she said, well, you know, I do think it's better for a woman, for a woman to die before her husband. And I thought, well, that's really strange. And it seems, I didn't really know what to do with it. And it was only after I had ongoing interactions with her that I was able to really understand the ways in which this ethic of sacrifice and of trying to be the best spouse, the best daughter, the best wife, the best Shia, the best Hyderabadi, sort of the best person in totality that you can be, that this isn't, you know, some kind of rejection of the world. It's not a devaluation of the self or of being a woman, but, you know, it's difficult to explain. It was an internalization of these models and this way of being in the world that you can't escape. If you go to a wedding, this story, you have to recite these mourning poems before you can get on to the joyful experience. And so if you're constantly reminded of the value of sacrifice, then it's impossible to let it go, and it's impossible not to want to take on that model. And another figure that I had some interactions with was a woman named Sarah. And Sarah wanted to get married desperately, and she really felt at a loss because she couldn't get married. She wasn't able, for a number of reasons, to find a viable candidate to be her husband, and she really felt as though she was missing out on having a full role in society. And listening to these narratives, while she believed deeply that Qasim or Fatima Zahra or other members of the Ahlul Bayt would intercede, it wasn't happening. And in that, I think also probably, even though she never talked about it, that must have been challenging in some ways as well. But she maintained this very deep faith that she would be able to become sort of a full individual if she just kept believing and kept going to the majlis and kept hearing these stories and kept trying to embody their exemplary qualities. And I had a lot of ongoing conversations with a select number of people. I also am very interested in just like choosing one event to focus on. I had a pretty small group of people that I ended up sort of returning to and engaging with over an extended period of time. And that provided really, I think, a deeper understanding. So interviewing both women and men of different ages, I was kind of able to see how life has turned out living, with this these very deep and rich traditions of belief. And then also by engaging with younger people, looking at the hopes and the aspirations of trying to cultivate this sort of idealized self. And so that's one, that's one reason why I chose sort of a few people rather than a large number of people to focus on. And there were a number of other people that I did interview, but I found these narratives to also be really, really engaging in very different ways.
I agree. I think you add a lot to our understanding by introducing these figures as well. To change gears a little bit, I want to hear your thoughts about this because you talk a lot about, throughout the book, ideas about kind of vernacular versus cosmopolitan ideas about Islam and what Shi'i Islam is. And in the final chapter, you focus on Keshafi and this text, The Garden of Martyrs, and how it's been problematic for lots of people, including Western academics. Can you talk about this in relation to this idea of the homogenization of Shi'ism in kind of contemporary period?
Sure. This connects back to those ongoing experiences that I had in Iran and with previous research that I'd done where certain genres of Shi'i devotional literature were, I think, partly through miscategorizing. So calling a text like The Garden of the Martyrs history, it's not history, it's a hagiography. And when certain genres are imposed upon a text, it opens it up to critique that perhaps isn't appropriate. For example, Ayatollah Murtaza Motahari saying, "This text in particular is terrible. It teaches superstition. It's full of lies and distortions." And so these critiques, I mean, it's also part of a longer tradition, especially coming out of Iran from the 19th century, that has I think, endeavored to create, in a sense, a more homogenized Shiism, particular with regard to devotional practices, that there is one way to perform particular rituals. And, you know, this goes back to certain types of texts. And, you know, we really should be able to see throughout the Shi'i world a similarity of a sort of ideal and ritual performance and dissemination of values. But the problem is, as I mentioned with hagiography, then these figures no longer are real, and they are real. So the members of the Ahl-e Bayt, these heroes and heroines of Karbala, are real people, but they're real because they're culturally relevant. They're vernacularized. They reflect local language. They speak in ways that are understandable. They dress in ways that are understandable, and you know, people can make associations in their minds. They're adaptable into people's local, both, well, real and fictive kin networks. For example, in India, people have extensive fictive kin networks where people just kind of get absorbed into your family. You know, this person is my real cousin, which actually has a whole other set of meaning. But in sort of one's heart and mind, that person has been adapted into the family, at least for that individual, if not for a larger collectivity within the family unit. The rituals that are performed, for example, the wedding rituals that I describe in detail in the book, the mendi and sachak and manja, the turmeric grinding ceremony, there are a whole bunch of rituals that are performed that are really distinctively South Asian and have a South Asian cultural valence, especially with regard to teaching gender roles. And so we can't separate out the vernacular, this sort of vernacularization where Karbala is in a particular place at a particular time, rather than this sort of cosmopolitan Shiism where there is a geographical place known as Karbala and it's for all people. So there's this abstracted Karbala for all people, for all time. But in a sense, I see that as somewhat empty. And my research showed that, you know, there has to be this common referent, but the common referent only becomes meaningful when it's put in that vernacular, that very specific context. And even North India is different from South India as far as ritual performance and how these figures, you know, kind of quote unquote play out.
I think you got it right on in the book. You do a great job of kind of laying out this vernacular process and why it's important in the South Asian context. Before I let you go, Karen, though, I appreciate you spending so much time talking to us. And I wonder if you could tell us kind of what you're working on now or what you have planned for the future.
Sure. Well, I have two projects that I'm currently working on. One I've been working on for the last few years and it will be a bit more of a long-term project on the Prophet's daughter, Fatima Zahra, and the ways in which her body is engaged in both devotional literature and ritual. Again, so I'm very interested in this intersection between text and practice, various rituals that have developed around Fatima, but devotional literature also has been very, very rich. And so I've been thinking about how I'm going to conceptualize this project, and it probably will be sort of a snapshot approach to take either different parts of her body and then, you know, if it's her heart, if it's her mind, if it's, you know, her smile even, and then take a, you know, do very close analysis of how that's engaged either in a particular text or in a body of texts or in particular ritual practices. And I'm still kind of conceiving of that, but I've published a few articles on Vathma. And I'm also working on a project, and I just finished doing some field work in Hyderabad this summer, and I'm going back in December, on how the bodies of the Imams and the Ahle Bayt have been, in a sense, reconstituted in South Asia, making it, transforming sort of the subcontinent into a sacred Shi'i landscape. And in this project, I'm looking at sort of distinct forms of embodiment, including relics, because relics play a very, very important role, especially when they're put into ulams. And these are not objects that are necessarily kept away for all of the year. In Hyderabad, for example, there are certain ashrakhanas where ulams are displayed year-round, and people go every week to make offerings, to do manat, so to make a vow. And so that's one thing that I'm looking at. So these objects or items associated with, they're not body parts, but items associated with the Imams or the Ahle Bayt that then are, you know, are integrated into the material religious life of Shias, sacred footprints and handprints, which we find throughout South Asia and have, I think, of, you know, reflect a distinctive religious milieu. Where we also have sacred handprints in other sort of imprints of the body in Buddhism and Hinduism as well. And food rituals, there are a whole range. Food has a really important role in Shiism. And there are rituals that are performed either by women only or on a regular basis. And there's a belief that this food has been touched and therefore sanctified by the Ahle Bayt. So I'm really interested in the role that food has. And I also want to look more at matam, this practice of self-flagellation and sort of a process of transference that happens, in which through the act of self-flagellation, individuals become like the heroes and heroines at Karbala. And what else? I think that's...
Sounds like a lot.
So all of these different ways, but this, the way in which sort of these disaggregated bodies, right, because the Imams are no longer alive, and the members of the Ahle Bayt are no longer alive, so their bodies are disaggregated. They don't exist physically as something that you can connect to. And so through all of these other forms, Shia can engage emotionally and relationally with these objects or sort of monumental, and I think of footprint, these sacred footprints and other objects in a sense as being monumental.
Well, that all sounds great, and I look forward to hearing more about that. Also, I apologize. There really is a lot more in the book that you go into great detail, and obviously in an hour, it's hard to explore all of that. But thank you again, Karen, for talking to me. And
well, thank you for interviewing me. I enjoyed it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks again for listening. Today we were speaking with Karen Ruffel, assistant professor at the University of Toronto, about her wonderful book, Gender, Sainthood, and Everyday Practice in South Asian Shiism, which was published by University of North Carolina Press in 2011.